This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Today, Pastor Sandy will continue teaching through the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 21, on this edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
You know, it's sad the Jews didn't fully grasp the ramifications of this important event. In Luke's account of the triumphant entry, he tells us that Jesus stopped along the road and he wept over the city of Jerusalem. In Luke 19, verse 42, Jesus says of Jerusalem, "If you had known, especially in this your day, the things that make for your peace, but you did not know the time of your visitation." You see, the Jews didn't grasp Daniel's prophecy and they overlooked his timing. Thus, the nation missed out on an incredible opportunity for peace. Israel rejected Jesus as their Messiah, and for the last 2,000 years, they've known nothing but servitude and suffering. Well, verse 10 continues, "And when he had come into Jerusalem, all the city was moved, saying, 'Who is this?' And so the multitude said, 'This is Jesus, the prophet from Nazareth of Galilee.'" Now, during the Passover, the population of Jerusalem swelled from its usual 200,000 to over 2.5 million people. Pilgrims came from all over Jewry. The city was teeming with people. And in 32 AD, trust me, all the folks could talk about was this prophet from Nazareth. The buzz was Jesus. It's interesting, the word translated moved is the word seismic, the force of an earthquake. It says that they were moved, the city was moved, saying, "Who is this?" Hey, the arrival of Jesus shook them to the roots. It shook up the entire city of Jerusalem. Then Jesus went into the temple of God. It drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. Now, as I noted, the Sunday before Passover was the day of preparation. And on that day, not only was the Passover lamb selected, but the house of the Jews was purged of leaven. And this is what Jesus does next. Now, understand, the Jews had hoped that Jesus would storm the fortress of Antonio, the Roman military compound there on the Temple Mount. He wanted them to cleanse that part of the temple. But Jesus instead went into the temple proper and he cleansed the Father's house of greed and corruption. Earlier in Jesus' ministry, during his first Passover in Jerusalem, he had taken a whip and he had driven out the money changers. Here, a whip is never mentioned. He overturned the tables of the money changers and seats of those who sold doves. Apparently, he did it with his bare hands. This is a bare-knuckle cleansing of the temple. Picture it in your mind. Money goes flying. Merchandise gets ruined. Doves are flying everywhere. Jesus ransacks the temple's business establishment. He lays hands on the Jews. It is a bare-knuckled exercise in discipline. And there are many lessons to be gleaned here, but don't miss the obvious. Jesus of Nazareth was no wimp. He's a man's man. Remember, Jesus was a carpenter, and carpenters in those days didn't go down to Home Depot to buy their lumber. They went out into the forest and they fell a tree. They timbered a few trees. Jesus was a muscular guy, no doubt about it, and he wasn't afraid to mix it up when necessary. When he got angry, nobody wanted to get in his way. In Jesus' day, the priests had turned the temple worship into a lucrative business. You see, when a sacrifice was brought to the temple, whether it be a dove or whether it be a lamb, it first had to be inspected by the priests for defects. And they always, trust me, they always found a flaw in what you brought them. That meant that you had to then go to the temple authorized dealer to get your lamb. The cost of those lambs was astronomical, almost as much as a gallon of gas. You could tell that it was a racket. The money changers were also in on this scam. You see, in Exodus 30, verse 13, the law of Moses required that every Hebrew male 20 years old and over had to pay a temple tax of half a shekel. The priests, though, wouldn't accept the Roman currency, since the Roman coins were engraved with a picture of the emperor. And so they had their own temple coins. To pay the temple tax, you had to exchange your Roman coins for temple coins. And guess what? There was a hefty exchange rate. The priests were getting a kickback on both the sacrifices and the temple exchange. The priests were making a buck off God. And Jesus didn't like it one bit. Jesus rips up the folks who were ripping off the flock. I have no doubt that Jesus is still ticked off today for the same reasons. No doubt about it. People are still making a buck off God. It is a sin to take advantage of a man's hunger for God by selling him ministry materials at exorbitant prices. Whether that's books or tapes or concert tickets, hey, covering costs and making a fortune are two different things. You know, actually, the worst part of what the merchants did was where it occurred. The market was on the south end of the Temple Mount, in the area known as the Court of the Gentiles. This was where an interested Gentile would come to pray and to learn about God. In other words, it was the only exposure that the Gentiles had to the true worship of God. And yet, they were being turned off by the obvious and blatant greed of these priests. If there is a court of the Gentiles today, I think it's the media. It's television and radio. These are the two venues available to unbelievers to just come and learn about the true God. I think of the guy, probably half-sauced, sitting there at night. His life is empty. He's trying to drown his sorrows. Just thinking, I wonder if God has anything for me. And so he turns on the television to the Christian TV station. Oh, don't do that. Whatever you do, don't watch Christian television. My, oh my. 9 times out of 10, he turns that thing on and he's exposed to some money-hungry televangelist. To me, this is defiling the court of the Gentiles. It's turning people off to Jesus before they're ever exposed to His grace and His truth. I think the picture we're painting today is as distorted as the corruption that existed in the temple in Jesus' day. One more point before I leave this. I would imagine that one of the most frustrating aspects of the sin that Jesus found in the temple that day was that He had already removed it once before. Jesus had already cleansed the temple of this very same sin. And I wonder if Jesus has the same frustration when He cleanses our lives. Sandy, why are you dealing? Didn't we deal with that 6 months ago? Why do we have to deal with that again? How often does Jesus deal with a sin in your life that He dealt with 6 months ago or a year ago or a year and a half ago? This is why we need a continual cleansing of the Word of God in our lives. Well, notice verse 13. And He said to them, "It is written, My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves." Notice Jesus comes into the holy temple, the temple of God in Jerusalem, and He says, "This is My house." It's His house. It belonged to Him and His Father. And here He quotes Isaiah 56, verse 7, the Old Testament verse read, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations." Notice Jesus says that it was not just a house for the Jews, but it was a house for all nations. The implication was that this temple was for the Gentiles as well as the Jews. That's why the Jews polluting the court of the Gentiles was such a treacherous thing in God's eyes. As a matter of fact, they had turned the house of God, as Jesus put it, into a den of thieves. Then the blind and the lame came to Him in the temple, and He healed them. But when the chief priests and scribes saw the wonderful things that He did, and the children crying out in the temple and saying, "Hosanna to the Son of David," they were indignant. Notice the priests realized the title "Son of David" was a term reserved for the Messiah. They understood that Jesus was claiming no less to be God's chosen. And the Jews said to Jesus, "Do you hear what these are saying?" And Jesus said to them, "Yes. Have you not read," and he quotes Psalm 8 verse 2, "out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants, you have perfected praise." Notice these chief priests didn't understand the pure simplicity of praise. Understand, true worship isn't the long, ornate, soliloquy, prayed in perfect King James English. That's not true worship. True worship isn't the perfect pitch of a polished, trained soloist. That's not true worship. True worship is the giggle of a little girl in the presence of a boy she has a crush on. True worship is the cooing of an infant resting in the loving arms of his mother. True worship is a child busting down the door when daddy pulls into the driveway, excited to see him as he comes home from work. You see, true worship is not something planned out and polished and prepared. True worship is the ecstatic response of a heart that has come in contact with someone that he loves and that he respects and that he admires. True worship doesn't say, "Give me." It simply says, "Thanks." It doesn't demand presence. It just enjoys God's presence. That's true worship. Jesus says, "Out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants, you have perfected praise." In verse 17, "Then he left them, and he went out of the city to Bethany, and he lodged there." Day one is complete. The first day of his last week is now over. The opening act of the drama in Jerusalem has come to a close. Jesus returns now to the eastern suburbs. He's gone over the top of the Mount of Olives, back to Lazarus' house, where he'll get a good night's rest. For Jesus will need it. Monday will be a busy day. And speaking of Monday, some of you old guys like me, do you remember back in the 1960s to the mamas and the papas? You remember that tune they used to sing? "Monday, Monday." That's right. Hear the lyrics. You want me to sing it? Oh, okay. All right. Don't worry. "Oh, Monday morning, you gave me no warning of what it would be. That Monday evening you would leave and not take me. Every other day of the week is fine. But when every Monday comes," I'm almost singing it, aren't I? "But when every Monday comes, you find me crying all of the time. Monday, Monday, couldn't guarantee that Monday evening you would still be there with me." The author must have spent a warm weekend with his girlfriend, but come Monday, she splits without him. It's interesting how the words of the song parallel this Monday in Jesus' life. He had been so warmly embraced on Sunday. He had rode his donkey into Jerusalem to the cheers of the crowd. But oh my, on Monday, the tide is going to change. The Jewish leaders are determined to trap Jesus, to discredit Jesus. The temple is going to be filled with tension. By the end of the day, these Jewish religious leaders, they're going to solidify their decision to murder Jesus. And we're going to find him on the Mount of Olives crying and weeping over the rejection of the Jews and the destruction that it'll cause. This infamous Monday was the last time that Jesus entered the sacred halls of the temple. It was the day the Jews rejected Jesus and the day that God rejected the Jews. Now in the morning, as he returned to the city, he was hungry. It was going to be a busy day, and so he skipped breakfast. Jesus didn't eat his Wheaties this day, and so his stomach was growling. And seeing a fig tree by the road, now fig trees are common in Israel. They grow to 25 foot high sometimes, as wide as 20, 25 feet wide, and they produce these broad leaves and, of course, some delicious fruit. Remember the village was mentioned earlier between Bethany and Jerusalem? The village Bethpage, it meant house of figs. It may have been in Bethpage that Jesus saw this fig tree. The fig tree was so common in Israel, it was a staple in the Jewish diet. You might say it was one of four major Jewish food groups: bread, grapes, fish, and figs. That was the Jewish diet. Jesus saw this fig tree by the road, but there was a problem. He came to it and he found nothing on it but leaves and said to it, "Let no fruit grow on you ever again." Now, with most fruit trees, leaves appear first, then fruit. But the fig tree is an exception. On a fig tree, the fruit precedes the leaves. Thus, when Jesus saw that this tree had only leaves, he knew that it was diseased and barren and had not produced any fruit, and therefore he pronounced on it a curse. And immediately the fig tree withered away. There are those that feel like Jesus was being sort of fickle here. I mean, you skip breakfast, you're a little grouchy, you know, you're stomach's growling, you come to a fig tree, there's no figs, and so you get angry and you just curse the thing. Understand, Jesus isn't being fickle here, he's being figurative. The fig tree was a well-known symbol of the nation Israel. You can jot down these verses, Jeremiah 8, verse 13, Hosea 9, verse 10, Joel 1, verse 7, Micah 7, verses 1 through 6, are just a few of the places in the Old Testament where the fig tree is used as an idiom for Israel. Jesus saw this fruitless fig tree as a figure of the nation Israel. She had leaves, lots of leaves, but no fruit. The Jews, you see, they had the trappings of religion. They had the leaves of good works. Israel had kept the rules and observed the rituals. She was clothed in her traditions, but behind the facade, beneath the leaves, there was no fruit. She was cursed. There was no real love for God. None of the gentle graces that are evident when a soul is in contact with the Spirit of God. Patience and joy and peace and kindness and endurance. Understand, what was true of the nation Israel can be true of you and me. You see, good deeds, charitable works, religious observance, tradition can all be like leaves. Oh, they make us pretty on the outside. They make us pleasing to man. But God sees past the leaves and he looks for fruit. And when fruit is absent, God brings judgment to that tree. You see, Jesus' stomach is still growling. Jesus is still hungry for fruit. He's looking for fruit in your life, not leaves. There is a rumbling in his stomach for fruit, not fluff. Are we manifesting the fruits of the Spirit in our lives? And when the disciples saw it, what Jesus had done, they marveled, saying, "How did the fig tree wither away so soon?" The parable of the fig tree illustrates the last 2,000 years of Jewish history. Jesus came to the nation looking for fruit, but found none. And as a result, the nation withered and died and has remained barren for the last 2,000 years. So Jesus answered and said to them, "Assuredly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but also if you say to this mountain, 'Be removed and be cast into the sea,' it will be done." It's interesting, the disciples, they missed the point of the illustration altogether. And they fixated on the power behind it. And Jesus reminds us of the tremendous power of faith-infused prayer. Do you believe in prayer? Do you believe that there is power in prayer? Here is the key to prayer. If you have faith and do not doubt. If we refuse to yield to the what-ifs. If we hold on to God's promises, he will answer our prayers. We can say to a mountain, "Be moved," and it will be moved. Verse 22, "And whatever things you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive." Now, when he came into the temple, now it's still Monday, and Jesus enters the same temple that he had cleansed the day before. Obviously, he had created quite an uproar amongst the religious establishment. These chief priests, they were the authority that had sponsored the ripoff. They were getting kickbacks from the gouging. And in their minds, Jesus had intruded on their turf. They're seething, they're angry, and they're looking for revenge. The chief priests and the elders of the people confronted him as he was teaching. Now, the Jewish hierarchy, they had confronted Jesus while he was teaching. Picture this. Picture Jesus. He's under Solomon's porch. He's surrounded by these huge columns, 40 foot high. They're stretching out in either direction, several hundred yards. A large, huge crowd is gathered around him, and the people are listening attentively. They're hanging on Jesus' every word. Suddenly, rudely, these chief priests, they barrel through the crowd, and they interrupt the master. This is a fight Jesus didn't go looking for. It came to him. This is not some low-key approach. Jesus is being publicly challenged here by these chief priests. And they said, "By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority?" Now remember, these were the chief priests, and I mean chief. They were the barons of Judaism. They were the so-called representatives of God. They were the brokers of Jewish authority. And if they had not authorized Jesus, where did he get his authority? On many occasions, Jesus had explained that his authority had come from God. But here Jesus answers their question with a question of his own. But Jesus answered and said to them, "I also will ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I likewise will tell you by what authority I do these things." Sounds fair enough. Here's this question. The baptism of John, where was it from? From heaven or from men? And they reasoned among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say to us, 'Why then did you not believe him?' But if we say from men, we fear the multitude, for all counted John as a prophet." And so they did the courageous thing, the really bold thing. They went out on a limb here. These are the chief priests, and under the gun, they rise up and they say, "We do not know." Talk about wimping out. And Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." Touche. The chief priests have tried to corner Jesus. They want to bully him around. They want to bruise his standing before the people. Instead, they're the ones that walk away with egg on their faces. It's hard to argue the Bible with the Bible answer man, isn't it? Jesus goes on to tell these chief priests three stories that testified to his authority. He does so without giving the chief priests any ammunition to use against him and to publicly condemn him. Jesus is brilliant. Verse 28. He says, "But what do you think? A man had two sons, and he came to the first and said, 'Son, go work today in my vineyard.' He answered and said, 'I will not.' But afterward he regretted it and went. Then he came to the second and said, 'Likewise.' And he answered and said, 'I go, sir.' But he did not go. Which of the two did the will of his father?" Notice the second son substituted saying the right words for making the right choices. Now, I don't know if you found this, but I have. It's easy to do. It's so much easier to say the right things than it is to do the right things. You know, I've discovered that you can talk long enough about a subject, you can talk thoroughly enough about a subject, that it makes you believe that you're a participant, that you're an expert, that you've already done what you've been talking about when you really haven't. There are sports writers I know who've never played an inning of baseball, but they've talked so much about baseball that they walk around like they're experts, like they're players themselves, like they're Hall of Fame players. Hey, just because you talk about obedience doesn't mean that you're going to obey.
Thanks for joining us today on Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. We come to you from Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. We're currently going through the book of Matthew from the New Testament. Matthew, one of Jesus' disciples, wrote this gospel to present Jesus as the promised king and Messiah of Israel. From the genealogy that ties Jesus to David and Abraham, to the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies, Matthew emphasizes that Jesus is the culmination of God's plan. Through his teaching, miracles, and life, we see the kingdom of heaven breaking into the world. As we walk through the life of Christ, we're invited to reflect on what it means to follow him as the true king. How does Jesus' kingship influence your life today? If you have any questions about the message you just heard, or if you have any prayer requests, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 770-736-2828. Again, that's 770-736-2828. You can also find more information on our website, sandyadams.org. While you're there, you can listen to our other teachings, or you can also download our mobile app to listen to these messages wherever you are. Join us again next time as Pastor Sandy continues to teach through Matthew on Sandy Adams Radio.